Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thank you yet again for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. As I'm sure you are all painfully aware, the state of American journalism is pretty pathetic these days. Trust in mainstream media has completely collapsed in recent years for obvious reasons, namely that the mainstream media has been exposed as little more than propaganda outlets for the Democrat Party, carrying water for left-wing politicians and elites, and for globalist entities like the United Nations and the World Health Organization, pushing left-wing agendas like open borders and the climate change Great Reset. Lately on The Right Take, I've had guests who are outstanding independent journalists like my friend Peter Schweitzer, Michael Schellenberger, guys who are breaking the most important stories of our time about top-level political corruption, big tech censorship, climate change hysteria, the Chinese corruption of our youth, and many others. These guys aren't just opinion-spouting network talking heads. They are doing the truly vital work that we count on real journalists to do. And today I have another journalist as a guest, an old-school, globe-trotting reporter with a life full of fascinating experiences, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him about some of those today. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we are having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. Today at The Right Take is an astoundingly interesting guy. He's a journalist and war correspondent, the best-selling author of at least a dozen works of nonfiction and a few novels as well. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and that's got to be a first time for a guest on my show, for his work exposing Iran's nuclear weapons program. I've known him for years, and on a personal note, I'll just say that for all that he's been through as a globe-trotting journalist, he's always upbeat and never without a big grin on his face. I'm honored to have him as a friend. Ken Timmerman, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Mark, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. I want to make sure that I mention at the outset, though, that you put out a weekly email newsletter called Threat Watch. It's weekly, right?
That's right. Every Friday, and I do it kind of the day before. I do a show called Prophecy Today Weekend, where I talk about geopolitics, what's going on the past week. Basically, Iran, China, and Russia.
Yeah, I get that newsletter, and I think everybody who wants to be informed from an insider's perspective about issues ranging from Iran to China and Ukraine and everywhere else should sign up for it. Should listeners just go to kentimmerman.com to do that?
That's the easiest way, and there's a pop-up, and you put in your name and email address, and that's it, and it's all automatic, and you have to make sure that you look in your junk folder the first time, but yeah, that's all you have to do.
Ken, your latest book is a bit of a departure for you. It's a memoir called Raising Olives in Provence, A Guide for Body and Soul. I'm actually reading it now, and it's very charming and entertaining. It's a nice break from the political madness of the sort that you and I normally deal with. I'll ask you about that book in a minute, but I want to back up first to your previous book, which is an absolutely epic memoir called And the Rest is History, Tales of Hostages, Armed Dealers, Dirty Tricks, and Spies. I got a copy from you the last time I saw you, I think, at the Freedom Center's annual Restoration Weekend, and it is a wild ride through your life in journalism. Let me just begin at the beginning with that. As a young writer, you had no intention of even becoming a journalist, did you? Tell us how you wound up on that track.
That's right. I studied with John Hawkes, who was a novelist at Brown University and the Master of Fine Arts program, and I got out with a master's degree at the age of 21 and was supposed to be teaching in university after that. And I said, I don't know anything. I really don't know anything. I've studied literature all my life and don't know a thing about the world, about power, about money, about the real world, the real life. So I went to Paris with a novel in my suitcase and $500 and wound up staying for 18 years and having three children there. And it was, life is not always what you expect it to be. But so I thought I was going to be a novelist. I set up a literary magazine called Paris Voices out of Shakespeare and Company in Paris, right next to Notre Dame, the big cathedral.
And Shakespeare and Company is the famous English language bookstore there in Paris, right?
You bet. It's the place where it was rebought by other people. But, this is from the 20s with Hemingway and Fitzgerald and the whole, lost generation, all those American expat writers. And we thought that we were following in their footsteps. I was kind of a young Ernest Hemingway, or so some people thought. And it's kind of funny. In the cover of the book, you see what And the Rest of History is all about. There's a picture of me at Shakespeare and Company reading from my first novel. Beard, round glasses, turtleneck sweater, and a gitan in my fingers. You can't see the gitan, but there's a gitan, a black French tobacco in my fingers. And then down below is me, many, many years later as an investigative reporter on a U.S. Customs ship, go fast boat in the port of Miami, so I went from this left-wing kind of radical pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli, anti-American leftist, philandering leftist in Paris, to a born-again Christian Zionist in America, conservative, supporter of Donald Trump and of conservative causes many, many years later. And it is the story of a transformation, how you go from that young guy in Paris to becoming that person that I became now as a conservative, born-again Christian.
Yeah, like many conservatives, myself included, you started out on the left. Tell us the amazing story, if you will, of the experience, that singular experience that kind of prompted not only your political conversion, but also your religious conversion.
Right. And so I went to Beirut. Again, if you're going to be an Ernest Hemingway type of figure, you've got to do stuff. You got to go to dangerous places and go to war. So I said, okay, I've got all these Lebanese friends, students. I was teaching them in Paris, and they said, you've got to go to Beirut. And I was pro-Palestinian, so I talked to the Palestinians. Their ambassadors had sent cables. They told me ahead of time I was going to be welcomed with open arms in West Beirut, then under siege from Israel, 1982. And as soon as I get there, of course, they take me hostage. And all of those introductions came to naught and put me in a dark underground cell with about 20 other people crowded together. It was like walking on squid when they closed the door and pushed me into the cell. And I was held there for 24 days, bombed most of the time, day in and day out, and beaten as well by the Palestinians. And that was really when I realized that I had a savior, and he was there with me at every single moment. And I also understood that the pain that I felt was just a fraction of what he had endured for me. And that really reawakened. I was raised a quick Christian, but not that way. I did not have a personal experience with my savior when I was growing up. And that really, it changed my life. It changed my life completely. I like to believe that it's informed many of the most important decisions I've made since then.
And you weren't deterred from becoming a journalist or pursuing that career by being tortured, were you? Because I think that would kind of turn me off to the prospect.
No, I wasn't. And that, I guess, is my character. But it's also, having been saved in Beirut, God's plan was not for me to die in a cellar in Beirut. So why not go back? So I kept going back to Lebanon. I went to Israel. I wanted to go to the West Bank to see the Palestinians who had taken me hostage, to see how they lived in the West Bank. I wanted to see both sides of that Middle East divide and see what it was like. And it was a learning process. I went to Egypt and stayed for about 5 months, learning Arabic and working as a hospital project on a work site for a French company to learn Arabic and to learn about Egyptian culture and about the Middle East. Then started covering the Iran-Iraq war once the crazies went into the Commodore Hotel and shot up the booze. I said, when they shoot up the booze in Beirut, there's a real problem.
Well, your memoir consists of about 70 short chapters and many, many interesting stories of your life and work. Apart from being taken hostage and converting to a Christian conservative, is there another favorite tale of yours from that book that you could share with us? How about the story of how you became an arms dealer? Because the subtitle of your book is, the subtitle is Tales of Hostages, Arms Dealers, Dirty Tricks, and Spies. And that's you. You're referring to yourself as a hostage, an arms dealer, and spy.
Yeah, exactly. How I became a hostage, an arms dealer, and an Israeli spy. And this book is an Israeli spy. But so the arms dealing part started in 1983, 84, quite inadvertently. I was working for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution at the time, doing stories mainly on the Middle East, but then I started to do some stories about NATO. And the U.S. Embassy said, oh, you've got to talk to this Colonel Mark Broman. He handles all of our NATO affairs. So I talked to him, interviewed him a couple of times. We became friendly. And he was getting ready to retire, and he said, I want to make you a proposition. I want to hire you for this new defense company and defense magazine group that I'm setting up with another friend, former CIA. I want you to write for us and, basically run our office. I said, sure, that sounds like a great opportunity. And bit by bit, it turned out that that was only a piece of what they were doing. So I would write articles for them about the French defense industry. But then he said, well, look, we'd like you to go to Cairo, since you spent time in Egypt, and talk to the Egyptian military. We're going to set you up with the U.S. Embassy there in Cairo. Talk to the Egyptian military about buying their used F-4s. This is a time when the U.S. was going to replace their F-4 aircraft, fighter aircraft, which, you know, kind of Vietnam era, with F-16s. And said those were going to come on the market. And I said, okay, yeah, but who's going to buy them? Oh, Paraguay. Here, we got this end-use certificate. I didn't have a clue what an end-use certificate was at that point. I was 30, 31 years old. And I said, okay, well, this could be interesting. So I go down to Cairo, stay in the nicest hotel at that point, was the Nile Hilton, and meet with the proper guy first at the U.S. Embassy, who introduces me to the guy at the Egyptian military, a general named Usri Khatib. And he's very pleasant. We speak Arabic a little bit. He's very impressed. I talk about the hospital I'd worked on. And at the end of it, he said, he looks at this paper that I handed him. He said, Paraguay, huh? Do you know if Paraguay even has an air force? And I said, oh, I will not say the expletive that went through my mind, but I said, I better go find out. And I went to the American University in Cairo, looked it up in one of these military yearbooks, and found out that their air force consisted of 6 jet trainers. That's it. And the amount of these this contract for 32 F-4s would have been the same as the entire annual defense budget of the country of Paraguay. So I go back to the next day. I said, okay, well, sir, there must be some mistake here. I would go back to Paris and figure out what's going on. So I go back to Paris, talk to the colonel, Colonel Broman, and I said, you tricked me. He said, what do you mean I tricked you? He said, you sent me there on false pretenses. He said, you mean you didn't get it? You didn't understand this was for Iran? And I said, no, I did not understand it was for Iran. And that kind of intrigued me. And from then on, I started taking notes and saving documents and used those in an early book. One of the partners of Broman got arrested by the feds in 85. And I went on to take the story to the New York Times in 1987. This was after Iran-Contra hit. And this was the kind of the first draft of the Iran-Contra affair, was this group of people that I was involved with in Paris. And the New York Times hired me as a consultant to do this story with another writer, Stuart Diamond. And when they finally put the story together and printed it on the front page, they called me an arms dealer. And I was insulted. I was really infuriated by that. And so I talked to my agent who was with the New York Times. He says, Ken, what's the big deal? They spelled your name right, and now you're an arms dealer too. So there I am. So now I'm an arms dealer, even though I thought what I was doing was actually reporting on the arms deals, but no, I was labeled as an arms dealer. Oh, and he said, the New York Times actually did you a favor. they paid you a compliment because they said they re-interviewed all the people you talked to and found out that all of your information was accurate.
Well, that's got to be great to have on your business card. Ken Timmerman, journalist and arms dealer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so anyhow, so that was the Army. And those guys, the guys who were arrested, were ultimately released during Iran-Contra because they convinced a federal judge that if the government can do it, well, you know, I was just there before the government was doing it. But it was the U.S. government's bidding.
Well, your book is filled with great stories like that. I highly recommend it. But let's talk about current events for a moment. Our woke military leadership has declared our two biggest existential threats to be climate change and white rage. Your newsletter is called Threat Watch. What do you think the real existential threats to America are? And that could be either external or internal.
The internal threat is probably the most grave. We are in the process, I think, of destroying the greatest experiment in world history, and doing it conscientiously, doing it methodically, by starting in the schools with children in kindergarten, by teaching them that sex is not a biological factor, that it can be any sex that they want to be, and that freedom is really not important, and America is the worst country in the world, not the best and the most virtuous. Our listeners understand this. It goes on and on and on. But that I think, truly is the greatest threat. We will do what Rome did to itself at the end of the Republic, was when they no longer respected their borders, they no longer respected Roman citizenship, they gave it to anybody. And then they said, well, you know, look, everything's for sale. And the whole society became corrupt. We are corrupt from top to bottom, unfortunately, in America. The deep state is just the euphemism that we use to express this corruption. But that's what it is. It is a deep corruption where America doesn't count anymore. American corporations, there isn't such a thing anymore. They're international corporations, and they do not believe in America first. You know, Apple manufactures all of his phones in China, for example, as do most of our computer and electronics and high-tech companies. It's really quite disgraceful. I can remember, Mark, and you do too, in the 90s, I was working for the American Spectator doing Communist China. I was doing investigations on the Chinese penetration of America, penetration of the Clinton administration, and their stealing of our high technology. I did a story about the B-1 bomber plant in Columbus, Ohio. That's also in the book, and the rest is history. And I got a tip off from people in U.S. Customs and from the Machinists Union, both of them, saying that the plant officials are bringing in communist Chinese military intelligence officers after midnight to tour the plant because they're shutting it down. They're no longer going to make the B-1 bomber. And the Chinese are pointing, yes, I want this machine, I want that machine, I want this one over here, all stuff that costs us billions of dollars to develop just for the B-1. So it was pretty fancy stuff, profiling machines, machines that were big enough, machine tools big enough to make the entire leading edge of the wing of a B-1 bomber, big stuff, big, big stuff. And so I was looking at this at that point. The Chinese in the 90s were just beginning. Clinton opened the door to them. Today, they have succeeded in everything that they were just dreaming of in the 1990s. In the 1990s, their aircraft, their jet aircraft, the joke was a Chinese MiG runs out of gas before it hits the end of the runway, taking off. Nowadays, if you look at the latest version of Top Gun Maverick, those Chinese fighter planes, wow. And that's not pure fantasy. The Chinese have just leapfrogged us in new technologies. They have a bigger navy than the United States does today. They have more ballistic missiles, ground-based nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles, than the United States does today. In the 90s, they had maybe 200. So the Chinese clearly have a goal of world domination. The Russians do not. So I don't consider Russia to be the threat that most in the Democrat Party believe it to be. But the Chinese want to dominate the world. And they want to dominate the world economically if they can. They'd like to dominate it politically, for sure. They don't necessarily have to dominate it militarily, but they have to intimidate it militarily so we will not move against them. And that's what they're doing. And they have a president now in the United States who is bought and paid for. So they think that they can get away with anything they want.
I had another journalist friend of mine, Peter Schweitzer, on the podcast the other week. We talked about China and this the so-called disintegrative warfare that they're waging against us. What do you think we can do to turn the tide and reestablish our superiority over China, and that's militarily and otherwise?
You know, I think it starts really, Mark, with leadership. Remember what President Trump did early on. He invited President Xi to Mar-a-Lago. At the same time, he was preparing to impose 100% tariffs on Chinese goods coming to the United States. He had his arm around the shoulders of President Xi of China in Mar-a-Lago and you know, let him drive golf carts and all kinds of stuff and made him feel very friendly. So Trump had a leadership style, which clearly neither Biden nor Obama had, and it was to not to embrace our enemies, but to let our enemies know, I know who you are. I know your country. I understand your country. I understand what you want. Here's what we want. Here's who we are. And here are the red lines you will not cross. And if you do cross those red lines, it will be at your peril. And that's the very first thing that has to happen. I think we have to have a president in the White House who can tell Putin and tell Xi that, look, America is back. We are still the world's greatest military power. We haven't gone away in those 4 years. We just were sleeping in probably, you know, just sleeping in the White House bedroom somewhere. But no, America is back, and we will not let you get away with the kind of things that you thought you were going to get away with.
You covered Iran for a long time. Is Iran more dangerous now to the U.S. than it's been for a long time, maybe since even the Iranian Revolution of 79?
Iran is far more dangerous today than it ever has been, and for the simple reason, because it has far greater capabilities. It has far greater wealth. Again, President Trump had a maximum pressure campaign against Iran, where he not just imposed sanctions on them, he enforced those sanctions. So the Biden people, they say, oh, no, we got all these sanctions on Iran. They don't enforce them. The Heritage Foundation, I think it is, recently estimated that just in the first 2.5 years of the Biden administration, the Iranians had been able to earn $71 billion that they would not have earned from their oil sales had the Trump sanctions been enforced. So the Biden people have basically re-empowered the Iranian regime. They have re-empowered this regime to repress their own people, to put women in jail for not wearing the Islamic headscarf in ways that they deem correct, to fund all of these proxy groups in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, and in Gaza. You know, Hamas is an Iranian proxy, the same Hamas that attacked Israel on October 7th. So the Iranians have been able to do that because the United States government has allowed them to do it. The United States government has enabled them to sell their oil clandestinely while claiming that sanctions are in place, but not enforcing those sanctions. And who's been buying it up? It's been mainly the Chinese. So you've got this amazing triumvirate now, this axis of, I call it an axis of opportunism, of Iran, Russia, and China. And the Chinese buy the Iranian oil. The Russians give Iranians strategic technology, ballistic missile technology, and the Iranians supply stuff like drones, lower tech drones, to Russia in large quantities. And everybody benefits, and except, of course, for us and the forces of freedom and democracy around the world.
You mentioned Hamas a moment ago. What about on the Israel front? What kind of long-term damage do you think the Biden administration is doing in the region by essentially supporting Hamas and throwing Israel under the bus?
You know, at the very beginning, I went to Israel a couple of weeks after the attacks, and the change in the Israeli population was really stunning to me. I took a friend, Ricky Schroeder, who's a filmmaker who wanted to do a film with the IDF. He had never been to Israel before, so I took him to Yad Vashem, I've been there many times. You probably have as well. And this is the Israeli Holocaust. It's the first Holocaust museum. And after the Hamas massacre, all of a sudden it took on a completely new meaning. All of those films from the 30s and the early 40s where Jews are being rounded up, Jews are being massacred, they're being shot. You think that that was history. No, it was not history. It was yesterday. It was October 7th. The same thing happening all over again. And Jews in Israel, every Jew in Israel understood it. Every person in Israel understood it. And the thing ultimately that I came out with, and I wrote a paper for this about this for the American First Policy Institute, where I work as a senior fellow now, was that there can be no turning back, as Biden is trying to do, to a two-state solution to a Palestinian state. There is no way that you can stand up with a straight face, look yourself in the mirror, and say, Israel, you must accept a Palestinian state run by people who want to slaughter every single Jew in Israel. It's just unthinkable. It's obscene. And that is something that has changed. Even those on the Israeli left who thought that they could make peace with the Palestinians understand that the only peace cannot come until there's been a total de-radicalization of Palestinian society, starting with those three-year-olds who are in the United Nations schools that Biden has funded. Remember, Trump cut off funding to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. And Biden restored it almost immediately as part of his I will do everything that Trump did not do policy, like insulting the Saudis, which he also did when he came, like sucking up to the mullahs in Tehran. So those schools have to be dismantled. There has to be a thoroughgoing de-radicalization. And as I wrote in this piece for America First Policy Institute, again, this is a generational effort. This is like Moses and the Hebrews crossing the desert, the Sinai. They cannot come into the promised land until that older generation dies off. And the tragedy of this, Mark, the tragedy for the Palestinians, is that that older generation today is just 3 years old and 4 years old.
Let me jump to another part of another country, another part of the world. You reported a lot on the war in Iraq. The general attitude today seems to be that that whole venture was a debacle for the United States. Did we mess up there? What is your take on what we accomplished in Iraq?
Well, it was a debacle, but it was a necessary war, unlike the war in Ukraine, which is an unnecessary war. I reported again in And the Rest is History. You can read all about the arming of Saddam Hussein. I was there through most of it. I interviewed just about every arms dealer who went to Baghdad. And the big secret about arms dealers, Mark, is that they love to talk, but they'll talk in whispers in bars or on hotel balconies, not any place they could be recorded. But yeah, Saddam Hussein was a real threat, and he was a threat in 2003. We were justified to go in. He did have weapons of mass destruction. One of the proofs of that is in 2007, so 4 years after the war, the new Iraqi government sells 1,000 tons of uranium to Canada. Now, what are they doing with 1,000 tons of uranium if they don't have a nuclear weapons program? They didn't have any nuclear reactors. They had it there so they could enrich it. So that's just one of the many, many indices. Did we screw up? Yes, we did screw up. George W. Bush screwed up. And he screwed up by appointing somebody, Jerry Bremer, to run the occupation of Iraq. It was not planned as an occupation. I remember Donald Rumsfeld said at the end of April, early May, we have accomplished our goals in Iraq. We've overthrown Saddam. We've destroyed his army. And now we put in place the Iraqi Governing Council, which we had been training for the task for 5 years. These were our guys, right? And they were Kurds, they were Sunnis, they were Shias, led by Ahmad Chalabi, who a lot of people don't like, and that's a separate issue. But anyhow, they were working together, and they were ready to take over. And then Bush appoints Jerry Bremer to go there and be his guy on the ground. And the first thing Bremer does, who has never been in the Middle East, never been to Iraq ever in his life, he officially disbands the Iraqi army on day one. So now you've got 300,000 disgruntled guys without a paycheck but guns at home. Next, he fires the Iraqi governing council, our guys who are supposed to be running the country. And third, he abolishes the Baas party of Saddam Hussein right down to the level of school teacher and local rep. So now you've got another 2 million people who are disgruntled with no paychecks, who hate America. And a month later, there's an insurrection. And people are wondering, how could that possibly have happened? Well, Jerry Bremer made it. He made that insurrection happen with those three orders on the first day that he arrived in Iraq. And the rest is history, alas. It's a very bad history. It just went downhill from there.
As I'm sure you know, American trust in mainstream journalism today has basically collapsed. As a longtime boots-on-the-ground, old-school journalist, what's your take on the current state of American journalism?
You know, Mark, and you might have heard me say this at Restoration Weekend, I used to introduce myself as a war correspondent and investigative reporter. Now I say, you know, war correspondent and investigative reporter, when that was still an honorable profession. It is no longer an honorable profession. We have very few true journalists left in America. People who question authority, people who question, you know, the stories that they are told by those in power. That's what journalists are supposed to do. They're supposed to search for the facts, search for people who know the facts, search for documents, and present those to the public, not present a narrative. Today, the New York Times, which is still the paper of record, is all about the quote narrative. That was never the way it was when I was, growing up as a reporter in the late 70s and 80s and even the 1990s. There wasn't a narrative. There were facts. There were, and I used to, I can remember, I learned it at Newsweek in Paris from the Chinese dissident who was then running the bureau there. He kept files. He had files everywhere. He had files on everything. And when the file got thick enough, it became a story. And what did that mean? It means that you accrete facts, you accrete information. And when you have enough information, it becomes a story. That is not the way the media works today. They start with the narrative. They start with a story, and then they go looking for facts or quotes or anecdotes that might support it. And that is not journalism. That is propaganda. That is propaganda.
Would you say independent journalists and social media, as opposed to mainstream network media, are the way of the future for reporting the news?
There is a revolution going on, and you have independent journalists who are either on Twitter or on other social media platforms, and they're much better at it than I am. I have not succeeded in adapting to that. Maybe it's my age. I don't know. Maybe the fact that I don't really like social media at all. I prefer people to social media. But yes, I think that is the way. You see somebody like Michael Yan, who's been covering wars in the Middle East for the past 6 to 8 years or so on the ground, and a lot of other reporters who have done that, real reporters, people going there with their cameras, people going to Portland, Oregon with their cameras and transmitting live, or Tucker Carlson, what Tucker has done. I think Tucker he and I, we actually jointly won a journalism prize in 2011 from Accuracy in Media. A number of years ago, but still. So I've known Tucker for a number of years. I have a great deal of respect for him. I think that he is one of the few remaining reporters who actually asks questions. Now, I don't agree with everything that he does, and there are many things he does, for example, relating to Russia, which I think are misguided, and I think which are not. I don't think he is objective. I think he's a propagandist when it comes to Russia for very strange reasons, which I do not understand. But he does ask questions, and that is so important. He questions power. He does not accept the narrative, and he looks for facts. He is out there looking for facts that then become stories.
Speaking of Russia, what do you think is going to happen with the Russia-Ukraine war? Where are we headed with this?
I'm not sanguine. First, as I said earlier, this is a completely unnecessary war. Had Donald Trump remained in the White House after his election victory in 2020, this war never would have happened. It never would have happened. The only reason we had this war is because Biden went out imprudently and outrageously encouraging Ukraine, egging them on while spitting in the face of Putin, and at the same time telling Putin, well, if he made a minor incursion in Ukraine, it would be okay. Just don't make a major incursion and try to take Kiev. I mean, there were so many inconsistencies, but there was no reason, no strategic reason, no interest of the United States to make Ukraine believe that they were going to be a NATO ally and that we were going to defend them as if they were a NATO ally. And yet that's exactly what Biden did. It's exactly what he did. It was a huge mistake, a huge strategic mistake. We will pay for this for a long time. I do not believe that Russia wants to take over Europe. I just don't think that's true. I don't think that they could gobble up Europe even if they wanted to. I don't think they don't have the resources to do it, and I don't think they have the desire or the need to do it. Putin has certain limited goals. We might not like those goals, but they involve reintegrating Russian-speaking parts of the former Soviet Union that were broken off, and he would like to have those back. But he doesn't give a hoot about Germany. He does not want Poland. He might want the Baltic states. Now, that's where we're going to have a problem. We're going to have a problem over the Baltic states. And I am actually very worried about that. They are NATO members. They are very good NATO members, and they deserve to be NATO members. They were brutally occupied by the Soviet Union, by the communists, and like the Czech Republic, they were very thankful for their liberation at the end of the Cold War. So I am worried about that, but I am not worried about Russia wanting to march into Paris. Ain't going to happen.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about Putin and Russia. Ken, let's shift gears a little bit. Tell us what your latest book is about, Raising Olives in Provence, and why do you call it a guide for body and soul?
It's in a funny way, it's almost almost a sneaky book. I try to sneak up on people by telling, starting with these stories of French people and olives and olive orchards and mysteries on the hillsides and water pipes being cut off and what it's like to buy an old property as an American in the south of France, where generations of people have been envying you for that particular property, and you have no clue what's going on. So I started off with this kind of really simple, almost Peter Mayle type of story about Provence, right? The people and funny places and stories. But at the same time, I try to tell a story, a deeper story about love, about marriage, about friendship. And these are the stories that I tell in that book the love that my wife and I have shared for so many years, and you see it in soft ways and gentle ways, the friendships that I've developed with people here. And again, you see it in kind of soft and gentle ways. And I'm always coming back from horror stories. and so I give you a little taste of what my other life is like. And then I come back here to God's paradise, the little piece of paradise on earth that I believe that he reserved for me to make beautiful, to fructify, to make olive oil, but it was God's plan. The motto of the book in the very beginning, just to let even an innocent reader beware a little bit that it's more than just a travel story. It says, life is good, God is great, and Jesus is not a Muslim.
Yes. Well, you're actually doing this interview from that property in the south of France, aren't you?
I am doing this from the south of France, yes.
uh, Ken, to keep up with what you were doing, should people just go to kentimmerman.com and find your social media links and all that stuff there?
Yes, that's the easiest thing to do. And you can get on my email list. And I send out those emails on Fridays. They're not very long. I try to keep them very topical, very much to the point, and give you something that you might not have read about or really paid attention to that happened in the world the past week.
Yes, I can vouch for that because I get those newsletters. Ken Timmerman, thank you for coming on the Right Take podcast. Please keep up all the vital work that you're doing. You are a good and necessary man.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been an honor to be with you. I really enjoyed it. God bless.
Me too. Listeners, I highly recommend Ken's book, And the Rest is History, Tales of Hostages, Arms Dealers, Dirty Tricks, and Spies. And for a change of pace, get his latest memoir, too, Raising Olives in Provence. And thank you for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Takes so you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And again, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.